From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we get an update on events in Brazil and Venezuela from Tony Solo, who's watching events in the region from Managua, Nicaragua. Well, Tony, we've got the situation with Lula in Brazil certainly needs to be discussed, and also the various things that are happening in Venezuela, and the whole region seems to be popping with things. Paraguay's got presidential elections in 2 weeks, elections in Costa Rica. Let's start, though, with Lula and Brazil, because this is the B in BRICS. It's a big deal.
Yeah, I know, and it's a very important regional event because it brings home the fact that the regional elites, very like the elites in Europe, are completely subordinate to what amounts to an extremely counterproductive, self-destructive policy from the United States. Because, and if you, yesterday I put up the Spanish text of Lula's speech before he went off to hand himself into the police. And what he says there is that it reminds me so much of something that a writer whom I'm not entirely enthusiastic about, but who did have some good insights, named George Orwell. And he wrote in his book about the Spanish Civil War, the truth goes on existing behind your back. And however much the elites may push down on the aspirations of the majority, those aspirations are going to keep kind of pushing up towards the light, because that's their only option. Mm-hmm. And so there's a line in Lula's speech where he quotes a little girl who said to him, the rich and powerful may be able to kill two or three roses, but they'll never stop the advent of the spring.
That's right.
And that's, you know, and that's, and it's like, and the United States, and the United States diplomacy, for, you know, if one can call it that these days, is like the, you know, to mix metaphors, perhaps, the little Dutch boy trying to stop the hole in the dike, you know, because there's absolutely no chance that the regional elites and their Western European and North American patrons are going to deny the majority of people in Latin America or Africa or anywhere else their aspirations to a decent life. It's just not going to happen.
That's right.
So what we're looking at is another example of elite stupidity, trying to, instead of reaching an accommodation that is viable for both sides, you know, this just reminds one of the wisdom of the Chinese and their insistence on win-win negotiations, and what the United States model is zero sum. We win, right. You lose.
Right.
And that, you know, that just doesn't work in today's world. It may have worked back in the days when the West had infinitely superior military technology enabling them to commit genocide against all the peoples of the majority world. But those days are gone.
Right.
And so what we're seeing now, and something that's interesting is the enormous disconnect between I find it interesting. I don't know about you, Don. I just find it fascinating how Western corporate media are able to build up this massive disconnect between reality and their fantasy. So if you were to ask anybody in the West, in North America or Europe, just randomly, what do you think about events in Brazil, they'll say, oh, that corrupt politician Lula got sent to jail.
Right.
But the reality, if you look at what is the reality, you have hundreds of thousands, millions of people who recognize that the case against Lula da Silva in Brazil was completely baseless, no right. evidence, no proof,
right.
just suspicion, backed up by, initiated in fact, by a municipal level judge who was able to coerce a phony confession from somebody that he threw in jail as on preventive detention and offered the incentive of, well, if you give me what I want, you can get out of jail.
Right. This sounds like an awful lot like a plea bargain here in the United States, which is their motive.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that's, you know, and but what an indictment of American jurisprudence. And I use American in the, you know, in the sense of all the Americans.
Yeah, the regional, right.
And where does that jurisprudence come from? And there's a guy called Bruno Scarzini who I did a translation of his article about how events in Brazil have become a kind of template for the elites in order to impose their control on the region, albeit provisionally. And what he points out is that this jurisprudence is completely phony, and it's based on a complete manipulation by the elites, to the point where even the justices of the Supreme Court, in their deliberations on the last week's appeal by Lula for habeas corpus, because in Brazil the law is that the Constitution and the Criminal Code explicitly state that nobody should be imprisoned, nobody can be imprisoned, unless all their judicial options or possibilities of judicial review have been exhausted. And that's not the case in the case of Lula.
Yeah, it's not reviewable, really. All the reviews lead back to the original municipal-level judge.
Right. Exactly.
And it's so ridiculous.
But if you look at that, if you look at the judgment, what half a dozen of the judges said was that, and it's important to bear in mind that Lula's case was accelerated. It was brought forward in the calendar of cases to be reviewed, because most left-wing, most progressive analysts in Brazil assumed that because the case was only scheduled to be reviewed by the Supreme Court long after the elections that are scheduled for July or early August, that Lula would be able to participate in the election campaign. But the Supreme Court took a political decision to bring that judgment, that review of the case forward, ahead of a couple of cases that were going to, in which they'd have to rule on whether the Brazilian constitution prevailed or not. In the sense that the Brazilian constitution stipulates that no one should be put in jail unless all their judicial options have been exhausted. And what Sergio Moro, the municipal level magistrate, has done with the connivance of his superior judicial authorities is put into preventive detention in a completely unconstitutional way potential witnesses in his corruption investigation. It's that coercive measure to an overwhelming degree that has made it possible for him to build a case against the various people that he's accusing in the accusation. But in the case of Lula, he has no evidence whatsoever, because the testimony of the person that he put into preventive detention and pressured to testify against Lula has been completely contradicted by subsequent events. The accusation was that Lula benefited from receiving a luxury apartment.
Right.
From this construction company. But there was The evidence that Sergio Moro, the investigating magistrate at municipal level, put forward was an unsigned bill of sale.
Right.
And then, apart from that, this phony testimony from the executive director of a company that subsequently, in a civil case, they were the ones who were judicially identified as the owners of the property, right. Not Lula.
Right, and Lula didn't have occupancy of it either. It's like
he never even spent a night there. He visited it once for maybe half an hour.
You know, like I have, you could go out on a Saturday in New York and visit, you know, 30 apartments.
Sure.
If that means, you know, I mean, I guess I could do like my dog does and take possession under the old-fashioned jungle way. But otherwise, it's impossible for me as a professional with 40 years experience in the title insurance business to imagine how just passing through gives you property rights. And what we're talking about here is like Vonnegut with Cat's Cradle. It's like, it's insane. There's no cat, no cradle.
Right. So the people casually reviewing any reporting on the case will get a completely phony idea of what's happened in Brazil, because essentially it's the one of the final chapters in the soft coup that started back when was it 2015 against Dilma Rousseff.
Yep.
And that was carried through. And what is the object of that? The object of that is to make it impossible for progressive, to shut down all the institutional avenues, the electoral avenues, any possible institutional space for a progressive option supported by the majority of the Brazilian people. And one saw that when, immediately prior to the Supreme Court judgment last week that infamously refused Lula da Silva his constitutional rights, going directly against, contravening directly the self-same Brazilian constitution of the Republic of Brazil. Immediately prior to that, a retired former head of the armed forces said, if Lula doesn't go to jail, there'll be a coup.
Yeah,
and then
right.
when the actual head of the armed forces was interviewed by a local media in Brazil and asked, you know, what do you think of that declaration by the former head of the armed forces? He said, oh, it's perfectly reasonable.
Wow.
And so, you know, and that was the context in which Lula has been jailed. So what? And so look at that in a regional. Let's step back and look at that in a broader context.
Let's look at the real broad context first, because there's this piece that you sent me the other day, and I pulled the site out of it that I sent back to you that I think tells the whole macro story. In 2014, the BRICS countries announced in Brazil an alternative financial system led by China and Russia. Today, Brazil is leading plans to sign a free trade agreement with the EU and to converge with the Pacific Alliance, the U.S.'s successor to the thing that got shot down surrounding China Trump killed.
Yeah.
So what they did basically, by removing Dilma Rousseff, they yanked Brazil out of the orbit of the BRICS, setting up a multipolar world, and made it one of the soldiers in line to establish a U.S., you know, hegemonic construct from Europe to Asia.
Yeah, and Bruno Scarsini, the author of that piece, and I sympathize a lot with his general point of view, and I think he doesn't give sufficient weight to the broader global context. And what are Argentina and Brazil really going to do? And what are the countries of the Pacific Alliance, Chile, Colombia, Mexico, principally, but also Peru? Chile, Peru, and Mexico that have signed up to the latest version of the Trans-Pacific Partnership,
right, TPP,
that was revived once the United States left.
Right.
But that's now led by Japan.
Right.
And all the signs are that, as you say, looking at it in this global macro level, all the signs are that Japan and those Asian countries are going to reach an accommodation. It may be a rocky road, but they're going to reach an accommodation with China.
Right.
Because why? Because the United States has opted for protectionism under Trump, because they know that they can't compete on a level playing field on equal terms with their major global competitors. They just can't. Of course they can't, because they've outsourced their years ago. They outsourced the power of their real economy. They outsourced that to China and other countries. So the real economy in the United States is moribund,
right,
while the parasitic financial culture continues to suck the lifeblood out of the United States' real economy. That's
right.
What's going on.
Yep.
Now, are Brazil, Argentina, Chile, Peru, Colombia, and Mexico, are the elites of those countries so irredeemably stupid that they're going to follow that model? Where do their best interests lie? And that's,
right,
you see, that's a question that I don't know the answer to that question, but it's an answer to it. It's a question that should be put, and it's by no means clear that, although people say, "Oh well, the Pacific Alliance is an economic model that's going to recreate the free trade area of the Americas that was defeated back in 2003, well, or whatever it was, by the combination of Lula," and that's another reason why Lula has been put in jail
for sure.
Lula, Nestor Kirchner, and Hugo Chavez, whom I'm convinced that the United States intelligence services
killed.
But and Nestor Kirchner, of course, died some years ago. Is that the case under the new circumstances that Cristina Kirchner, or Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, and Rafael Correa have recently been talking about in a very interesting interview that I think you also saw on RT?
Yeah.
And it's very telling that these kinds of real discussions about what is really going on in the world don't happen in Western media.
That's right.
They happen in other media.
Right.
And I think Bruno Scarzini's article is largely correct, but I think he underplays the uncertainty at a global level around what is going to happen with global trade and what kind of Pacific Alliance, what kind of free trade arrangements, free trade ha-ha, of course, arrangements are going to actually finally be agreed between the Pacific countries that are now operating in a framework that is not dominated by the United States, although it may have very strong influence from major multinational U.S. corporations, but is in practice is absolutely subjugated, as it were, to what China and the Eurasian Economic Area, the SCO, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, all these institutions that have been built up in the Eurasian bloc. And it's a complete fantasy to suggest that Latin America is somehow going to be isolated from all that, or that the elites in Latin America are somehow going to say, "Oh, we'd rather forego all kinds of opportunities that are coming up in Asia because we want to be loyal to the United States." Do people really believe that?
Well, not only that, that goes to the question of their intent as an elite, but then there's also the question of the material reality, which is no matter what they intend, it may be that it seems likely the circumstances won't allow them to do it, even as they steer the wheel that way. We saw accommodation of that reality as policy implemented by Hugo Chavez, for example, saying to countries like Colombia and other right-wing governments, "Look, we'll do business with you too. Keep your system however you want. And here's some incentives if you want to invest in your own people. period. And leaders there engaged at that level because the benefits to their own population were so substantial that if they ignored it, the people themselves would say, hey, where's my share of that?
Yeah. Now, something that Bruno wrote in his article is definitely the case, in that he explains in his article, and I think he's absolutely right, that the reason that people went after Lula, that the Brazilian elites went after Lula, or rather the Brazilian elites' leading economic interests in Brazil that do not affect United States corporate interests in Brazil, for example, the soya industry,
right,
the agro industry, right, mining interests.
The ones with their own interests that are being pursued, yeah, right?
So what Bruno's saying is that it was those elements among the Brazilian elite that went after Lula, and that also explains why they went after Eduardo da Cunha. Because Eduardo da Cunha, he was the right-wing mastermind that pushed through, with all the political connections, that pushed through the soft coup against Dilma. But he ended up getting sent to jail, just like Lula. Now, why?
Right.
Because Lula and da Cunha, whatever their political opposition, you know, the political contradictions between them, they both promoted the idea that Brazil's corporate elites should operate in a nationalistic way and not subordinate themselves to the interests of U.S. corporations.
Right, they're the local competitors to the global corporations. They ally with the global corporations to take out the Socialists or the Workers' Party or whatever, and then they get taken out by U.S. corporations.
Yeah, and that of course is the very essence of the U.S. campaign against Venezuela.
Yep.
So, should we start talking about Venezuela?
Yeah, we got to go there. Yeah, we've got about 7 minutes, so let's go there.
Okay. So, and if you look at Venezuela, what's now happening there looks as though there's the presidential elections on May the 22nd. One of the main factors that is going to influence the way voters go in that presidential election is, of course, the fundamental economic question of how they view the Venezuela's economy, given the fact that everyone in Venezuela, or certainly the great majority of people who are eligible to vote in those presidential elections, understand that Venezuela is at war with the United States and that the United States is imposing all kinds of economic sanctions that affect their ability to live a normal life.
Right.
So the question there, and now last year, we saw that in the elections for the Constituent Assembly, in the elections for the regional governorships, in the elections for the municipal authorities, in all those three elections, a great majority of the Venezuelan people supported the current Venezuelan authorities led by President Nicolas Maduro. Now, the challenge for the United States and its regional allies was, well, can we intensify the economic war against Venezuela to the extent that we can reverse that support for the Venezuelan government led by Nicolas Maduro? And all the signs are that they can't, because the Venezuelan authorities have managed to consolidate and even extend the support for low-income families suffering from the effects of the economic warfare of the United States. They've set up successfully, and incredibly, in my opinion, and what an incredible time scale that they managed to set up this alternative cryptocurrency called the Petro, which is the equivalent of issuing a national currency that is completely independent of the US dollar,
right,
for domestic purposes. Now that is slowly beginning to have an effect, because Nicolas Maduro and his colleagues in the Venezuelan government have told all Venezuelan government authorities that receive any kind of income for services that the government provides to charge those services in Petru, not in Bolivar's.
Right.
In Bolivar's converted to the Petru, and so the dollar becomes completely irrelevant, at least for those transactions between the government and the Venezuelan public. So, and there's that. There's also, and a practical example of that, for example, is that all the shipping companies that operate in Venezuela's various ports have now are obliged to use the Petro. And so that has a tremendous effect on...
Yeah, all the downstream prices, for sure. Everything, it comes through shipping, and now it goes through, goes out into the economy, and it's already been, purged of the dollar.
Yeah. So as that process advances and consolidates itself, running up to May, the question the presidential elections in May, the question then is, what is the United States going to do around the election, and what are they going to do if and when, as I suspect will happen, Nicolas Maduro wins those elections, and also, perhaps as important, that the United Socialist Party of Venezuela does much better in the legislative elections than they did back in 2015, because I think those elections, although they're separate elections, I think they're also scheduled for May. I'm not sure of the date, but we'll see. So what is the United States going to do? And I fear that once they realize that Maduro is likely to win those elections, what will happen is that Henry Falcón, the leading opposition presidential candidate, will say, well, the conditions don't exist for a free and fair election, and he'll retire. And then, if he does that, then all he'll be doing is ratifying a result that would have happened anyway, whether he participated or not. But the important thing about that is that Falcón now has the support of the more important Venezuelan opposition parties like Justice First, Primera Justicia, and Popular Will, Voluntad Popular. Why does he have that support? Because the United States has told their Venezuelan subordinates to support Henry Falcón, who is the leading opposition presidential candidate. And why would they do that? Because they want to have control or some level of influence over Falcón's campaign.
Yep.
And the fact that Falcón has agreed to that suggests that he is amenable to stringing along with orders from the United States State Department.
And, the context for all of this going into the election, by the way, is all of the levers have already been set for the U.S. to say this election was not legitimate. It's been declared that already by the Jordanian prince, Zaid, who's the current UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. He, the Lima Group, a whole bunch of others, all these different, essentially, tools of the United States have already said that the election is illegitimate and blah, blah, blah. And Venezuela conducts perhaps the most open elections and most democratic elections in the world.
Yeah, and the Carter Center has been saying that for years. Yep. But one of the aspects that is most astonishing and just gives a sign of how strong U.S. Coercion is in the international system is that the United Nations has refused to send election observers, despite being invited by Venezuelan authorities.
Which says everything that you need to say about it. Thank you, Tony. We're going to have to pick it up there next week. And we're going to keep a close eye on all of these things as they develop, because it looks like the future, at least the short-term or medium-term future of the region is back in play. So thank you very much.
You're very welcome, Don. Look forward to talking to you next time.
The same. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.